psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. Did you know the single fastest growing religious group in the United States is those who check none when asked their religious affiliation? That now makes up 20% of the U.S. population. And coming up, we will talk to an expert on this particular topic who's written a great new book called The Rise of the Nuns, Understanding and Reaching the Religiously Unaffiliated. Stick around for that in just a few minutes. And if you are involved in church leadership, let's say you're a pastor, a small group leader, involved in some kind of ministry work, you will find this topic something very, very helpful in your own work as you seek to reach the lost for Jesus Christ. And there's a lot of lost in our country right now. I think we would agree with that. Anyway, that's coming up in just a few minutes. And our phone number, by the way, if you missed it, 877-93-FAITH, jot that down because we'd love to hear from you this hour. And if you call us with your contact info, what we will do is put you into a drawing. And at the end of the hour, we have three copies of this book, The Rise of the Nuns, to give away, and you might win one of them. So just give us a buzz, 877-93-FAITH, and pass along your name, address, phone number, email address, and our producer, Kim, will take that down and contact you if you are one of our winners. Well, last week on this program, I mentioned that being bullied as a child can have a lifelong impact. And I found something interesting this week that you might not realize. And, you know, sometimes the media shapes our perceptions and makes us think things are really not the way they are. And there's some new research out on school bullying. And you may think, just based on what you've seen in the media, that school bullying is running rampant. And, you know, every campus is overrun by these hoodlums who are picking on these innocent children. Well, bullying certainly does occur, but here's what's interesting. A new study indicates that bullying and youth violence may actually be declining in America. The findings are based on a series of surveys that were done for over the last 12 years or so. They surveyed children and teens between the ages of 2 and 17 years of age, and they looked at a variety of different types of bullying. And they found that more than half of these types of bullying had declined in frequency during the study period. Assault and bullying both dropped by about a third. Sexual violence declined by a quarter. And they're not sure exactly why. Is it the fact that schools are paying more attention to this, that there's anti-bullying programs, some of which, by the way, we've mentioned this before, are not that effective. But there's an important caveat to this research, and that is, the researchers suggest that this decline may be partly due to fewer face-to-face interactions among young people. Why? Because of the increased use of electronic media. So, is there more cyberbullying these days? Maybe less physical bullying, maybe less in the moment one-on-one with fists and kicks and verbal intimidation on the playground. Perhaps it's happening in cyberspace. Perhaps it's happening through text messages and some of the blackmailing, the sex message blackmailing that's been going on of teenagers, which has been in the news. Perhaps it's putting somebody down on a social network site. So it's interesting that it's gone down, physical bullying, but I think the verdict is still out on the cyberbullying side of things. By the way, speaking of cyberbullying, the director of the prestigious King's College School in London says the online environment for kids as they grow up today can be, as he put it, brutal and critical. Headmaster Andrew Hall says social networking sites require every 21st century teenager to live his or her life under the eye of an electronic judge far more cruel than any examiner, school teacher, or parent. He says no previous generation has spent so much time online, liking, being liked, or being devastatingly ignored. Boy, that's painful just thinking about it, having your teenager shunned by the clique, by the peer group, through social media and texting. Now, Mr. Halls adds that today's teens live in the, quote, tortured drama of their adolescence under the scrutiny of hundreds or even thousands of others, a way of life that can make them feel small and vulnerable. Wow, that is some powerful language, but I think he really hits the nail on the head. There are so many kids who feel scrutinized by hundreds or thousands of others through social media, and it does make them feel small and vulnerable. And you know, mom and dad, that is one more reason for parents to monitor and limit their kids' online interactions. And not only that, to regularly debrief with them about their experiences, both online, in mobile technology, social networking, and say, hey, has anything happened recently that's made you scared or worried or upset? Because if we don't ask the question, we may never know that our child is being cyberbullied. We may never know that they are being ostracized by their peer group through that that venue. So please do be aware. And I'll tell you, the more I read about this stuff, the more concerned I get that our kids are just, their whole world now revolves around mobile technology and social networking, and there's a lot of damage that can be done. Not that there's a lot of great things as well. Certainly, relationships can be built there. I've talked to many youth pastors who say they keep in contact with their entire youth group on a daily basis through social networking and texting, and they send out Bible study verses. And so there's some great things as well, but I think we have to be aware of the dangers because, you know, we have an enemy, and Satan will turn even the good things against us. So, fascinating study and something that we'll be talking more about here on the Faith Radio Network in days and weeks to come. Well, it's 11:12, and coming up in just a moment, we are going to dive into the nuns, not the ladies that wear those black and white outfits. We're talking about the rise of the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated in America. A huge percentage of Americans now say they don't have any religious affiliation, perhaps not even any religious belief. And we'll talk to an expert on that topic up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
You know, it's not easy getting through adolescence today, and the effective parent must learn early on how to protect his kids.
Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
Perhaps the most painful aspect of growing up is related to the assault on self-esteem that is almost universal in today's teen society. Young people typically feel like fools and failures before they've even had a chance to get started in life. So how can parents brace their younger children for the teenage years to come? Is there any way to make that passage to adulthood any easier and safer? Well, one important approach is to teach boys and girls valuable skills, which will provide a centerpiece in their self-identity a few years later. Learning about basketball or tennis or electronics or art or even raising rabbits for fun and profit. You see, it's not so much what you teach your child. The key is that he or she learns something with which to compensate when the whole world seems to say, "Who are you and what is your significance as a human being?" The teenager who has no answer to those questions is left with an unprotected ego at a very vulnerable time of life. Developing and honing those skills may be the most valuable contribution parents can make during the elementary school years.
Hear more at MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And you can join the conversation by calling us at 877-93-FAITH. Why don't you jot that down? 877-93-FAITH. Put it on your fridge. If you're driving, write it in the dust on your dashboard so you won't forget. Also, our website, myfaithradio.com, and you can get in touch with us through my contact page there. My guest this hour is James Emery White. He is the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, which is often cited as one of the fastest growing church starts in the United States. He's also the former president of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Dr. White is the author of several books, including Rethinking the Church, What They Didn't Teach You in Seminary, and The Church in an Age of Crisis. And today he joins us to talk about his new book, The Rise of the Nuns, Understanding and Reaching the Religiously Unaffiliated. And Jim, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, before we dive into your book, I understand you are about to have a grandbaby. Is that correct?
My daughter is in the hospital as we speak.
Wow. Is she's in labor now?
Yes. So no baby yet, but she is there.
Well, congratulations in advance. I'm sure you're on pins and needles, you and your wife, and you're very first. So how's
very
it gonna,
first.
How's it going to feel being people call you Gramps?
I don't know, but we're excited.
Well, I'll tell you, in your photograph, you don't look like a grandfather. You look like a very young man. But it's really exciting, and I pray that delivery goes extremely smoothly, and that in another 12, 24 hours, you'll have a brand new spanking. Is it boy or girl? Do we know yet?
It's going to be a little girl.
Little girl. Well, congratulations. We have
two
little ones at home ourselves. Let's talk about this whole aspect of the religiously unaffiliated. What is the word nun? Where does it come from? And as it's applied to religious belief or religious affiliation?
Yeah, it's actually a fairly new term in terms of sociological studies on religion in America and other places. All it really means is that when they offer these tests, these surveys that ask people, describe yourself religiously, you know, and it typically would be things like Catholic, Baptist, Protestant. And what they found was that there has been this new category they've needed to create that simply says, I'm nothing, you know, a nun. And it has always been a very statistically small number until an explosion over the last really 20 to 25 years. To put it into perspective, in 1940, maybe 5% of the American population would fall into this category. By 1990, 50 years later, that had only grown to 8%. And then during the 90s, there really was what some have called the beginning of a secular boom. And from 1990 to 2008, it went from 8% to – it doubled to almost 15-16%. And then between 2008 and 2012, just four short years, it went to 20%. And so right now in the United States, it is one out of every five adults, 20% of the population would say that they are a nun. It is now the second largest religious grouping in the United States and the fastest growing.
That is stunning. Now, as sociologists look at this and the Barnas of the world examine these statistics, do they say that a lot of it is due to the rise of neo-atheism in America? Is it just that secularism has pretty much taken over and ruling many lives? What's behind all this?
It's really interesting because you would think that you would find atheism among the nuns. Actually, very few are atheists. The vast majority, 85-86% would say they believe in God. Many would say they pray on a daily basis. It's just that if you ask them, do you belong to a faith? Do you belong to a religion? You know, they would just say, no, I don't have any kind of – I don't want a label. I don't want to belong to anything. They don't have a set of beliefs that they want to label them. The two things that mark them, and then we can talk about how they got here, is that, number one, they're not atheists. And number two, they're not seeking either. They're not on a search for spiritual truth or for a religion or for a home or for a faith identity. They are very content being nothing. Now,
just
in terms of
fat and sassy, not going to church, not being affiliated, but yeah, I'm spiritual. I believe in God.
Yeah, they would say they're spiritual but not religious, and and very content to be so because of their perspective on organized religion and the church, which is exceptionally negative, as it is throughout all of culture. And what has led to this, and you know, this is really two things: the larger cultural reasons or the processes, as I'm sure you've talked about many times on your show, secularization, privatization, pluralization. Those three streams have decisively shaped our world. Secularization has removed religious things, spiritual things particularly, but religion in particular, from the marketplace, so that it's not really a matter of identity or support. Privatization means that whatever you do believe religiously is kept in the private sphere. Pluralization means that whatever it is that you might believe in that private sphere is just a matter of opinion. There's so many different truths and ideologies out there. The idea is that all of them are equally valid. Well, we could explore those three more, but those are the three things that have shaped and created this context. But if you talk to a nun, that's not what they're going to say. If you talk to them and say, why are you checking nothing on the box? They wouldn't say, because I'm a victim of the process of secularization. What they would say is lawyers, guns, and money, to rip off an old Warren Zevon song. Lawyers, meaning they view religion and those involved in religion as overly involved in politics and making everything an ideology. In terms of money, they just cite televangelist scandals and megachurch pastor mansions and everything else that just leaves a bad taste in their mouth in terms of materialism and greed. And then in terms of guns, just the idea that we're just a hateful bunch, homophobic, judgmental, inflexible, critical, mean-spirited. And so, you know, and the thing that makes it difficult, Bill, is that they're right. I mean, these things are present within the Christian community. And they will point to these things and say, that's why I don't want to have anything to do with it.
And I would agree that they're present, but Jim, I'm sure you would agree also that they've been blown out of proportion by the media, because the media loves to feast on this stuff.
True, but we sure have fed them a lot of layups, haven't we?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree that.
I mean, but, you know, it's one thing. I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, there's no doubt that when these things become news, they are thrown heavily into the 24-hour cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But that still doesn't mean that the media caused that pastor to be a serial adulterer. It didn't cause that pastor to buy how many thousand feet home. It didn't cause that youth worker to take advantage of a 12-year-old girl. It didn't cause that bitter blog and that cynical, nasty poster that says God hates fags. You know what I'm trying to say? That there is a sense where they may be seizing on a fringe, they may be seizing on a minority, and I certainly don't believe that it is truly indicative of what a life marked by Christ should be and often is. But that's what they see, and they can cite the examples. And that is just simply, without arguing with them, the point is that's what we're up against in terms of reaching them.
And yeah, the examples are there, but I'm guessing you, and I know so many believers, so many pastors who do not fit that mold, who are kind, who are caring, who live the fruit of the Spirit, who are trying to reach the lost in winsome ways. They don't get the press. They don't make the blogs. When Saddleback Church, what's the pastor's name there in Southern California? When Rick Warren does something incredibly wonderful, like he has done in going out and serving his community with thousands and thousands of volunteers, I don't see it covered by the NBC Nightly News. But I do see when that crazy fringe group goes and protests a soldier's funeral. So
yeah.
I think the media loves that.
Yeah, the dilemma is that almost becomes moot. It doesn't really matter. They are, in our day, they are products of and deeply influenced by media messages and obviously the educational system, judicial system. And we shouldn't be surprised that that is the perspective of those, because we live in a post-Christian culture.
Mm-hmm.
So really the thing is, rather than simply lament that, although it is lamentable, we need to kind of return to the fact that it almost doesn't matter. That's still their perspective, and that's mm-hmm. what we're up against in terms of reaching them for Christ.
So what's the best way, Jim, to counter that perspective, to offer them? I'm going to guess that you would say, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, by being authentic believers who are walking daily, in ways that reflect the beautiful fragrance of Jesus Christ in their actions, in their attitudes, in their speech, in their work, that when the nuns come into contact with those authentic Christians, they may, kind of pop the side of their head, and I could have had a V8. I mean, look, wow, I didn't realize there were really Christians, religiously affiliated people out there that were like this.
Yeah, and I think that certainly is the starting point, is that to see a life that has been, authentically following Christ and is authentically following Christ, and to see Christian communities functioning as authentic, biblically functioning communities. And that does arrest their attention, and that you would hope would be the assumption that would be in place no matter what. I think we have to go further, though, because there is a missiological dilemma here and something that we need to strap on. Let's assume what you've just said is in place. The challenge that we have in a post-Christian culture is to realize that it's a post-Christian culture and to adapt our strategy accordingly. Here's the quickest way I know to explain it. Most churches and evangelistic strategies are built on an Acts 2 mentality. And what I mean by that is Peter speaking before the God-fearing Jews in Jerusalem. And the people that he was speaking to try to present Christ were already monotheists. They were already believers in the Old Testament and its authority and inspiration. They believed that a Messiah was coming and the prophetic literature and material for that. I mean, he had an audience that was extremely advanced in terms of what he was trying to present. And his message was done accordingly. It was short. It wasn't even the length of a good blog. He essentially said, okay, you know all that stuff. Jesus was that Messiah. You killed him. He's risen again. You need to repent. It was not much more than that, and thousands did. Now, compare that to Acts 17. Paul on Mars Hill, totally different audience, so deeply pluralistic and agnostic that all they could agree on about God was that he was unknowable and never would be known, and that was the shrine they had. He had to go all the way back to creation to even begin to lay a foundation to present Christ. It took him a while, and then only a handful responded. It's because it was in a terribly different context. Well, here's my point. We are not in Jerusalem anymore. We are on Mars Hill, and yet so many approaches are taking an Acts 2 approach in an Acts 17 world, and that is going to be doomed to very little fruit.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, Jim, because I would agree wholeheartedly. And we'll unpack maybe some of those strategies that are ineffective and talk about strategies that will be coming up here in just a bit. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is James Emery White, the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the author of this wonderful book, The Rise of the Nuns, Understanding and Reaching the Religiously Unaffiliated. If you give us a call and give us your contact info, we'll put you into a drawing for a copy of one of these books at the end of the hour. The number is 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH. I'm Bill Meyer. We'll take a quick break here on the Faith Radio Network and be back with more after this.
Living by faith through life's ups and downs. The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Whether you're listening to us in Madison, Wisconsin, in the Fargo-Moorhead area, perhaps in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or Des Moines, or maybe a beautiful Duluth on the shores of Lake Superior, Waterloo, Iowa, or right here on Faith 900 in Minneapolis, St. Paul, we thank you so much for making us part of your Saturday. You can find the entire Faith Radio schedule at myfaithradio.com and learn about some of the great Bible teachers we have on this network, as well as some of our live programming on Christian worldview and discipleship and pretty much everything you want, Monday through Friday, and then our special programming on the weekend. I'm Bill Meyer. My guest, James Emery White, the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. James is also the former president of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary, and he is the author of a new book, The Rise of the Nuns, Understanding and Reaching the Religiously Unaffiliated. Now, Jim, before the break, we were talking about the failure of many old-line strategies, Acts 2 strategies, as you refer to them, to reach the religiously unaffiliated. And I'm thinking of that wonderful bumper sticker theology, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. Now, that is just woefully inadequate in today's pluralistic society.
When you talk about reaching these people, and Mecklenburg has 70% of its growth comes from the unchurched. So this is my world. This is just who I interact with and deal with on a daily basis. When you actually talk to these folk, I mean, they're good people, and they're trying to do the right thing, to live morally, and they really are confused. They are not our enemies. They are not the bad guys. They are the products of a post-Christian culture. They weren't raised in the church themselves, most of them. This is the first generation that has grown up in a post-Christian culture. So what we're talking about needing to do is to realize that whereas maybe in the 50s all the way up until the 80s in recent history, we could have evangelism that was largely event-based. It could be crusades. It could be door-to-door visitation. It could be revivals. It could be a bus ministry. It could be Sunday school. Things that are presentational in nature, almost cold call kind of evangelism. It was very effective because people had that Acts 2 God-fearing Jews in Jerusalem context, background. I mean, you could have short initial conversations and go quite far. And again, I'm not trying to say what the Holy Spirit can and cannot do. There can still be all kinds of Saul to Paul experiences. But I'm just observing what tends to happen in these cultures when the Holy Spirit is on the loose and how he tends to work. They tend to be harder nuts to crack. In our day, we have to recapture a sense of evangelism as both process and event, getting them from, as Paul did, from creation all the way up until the time of you're talking about Christ. And that's something that we're not used to doing. We're not used to evangelism as process and event. We know how to do event. We don't know how to do the process. And then when we look at what's involved in the process, it is so uncomfortable. It is so change-oriented that it is resisted at a visceral level. And that's why we remain so ineffective.
Let's give an example. First of all, maybe define process-oriented evangelism, and then how you've personally seen it, both as a seminary president and as a pastor in your community, being rejected by, let's say, other churches or Christian leaders.
Well, let's just set up an imaginary scale between 1 and 10. And let's say that 10 is that moment where somebody comes to saving faith and knowledge in Christ. I would argue that in the 50s through the 80s, just to use recent history, the average unchurched non-Christian that we might talk to in America was already sitting on an 8. They believed in God. They believed truth existed. They had a positive background in the church. They had a rudimentary knowledge of the Bible. They had a built-in sense of guilt or conviction that kicked in when they violated some of the basic tenets of the Judeo-Christian value system. I mean, they had a lot in their pedigree. Therefore, you could do kind of an event-oriented approach to evangelism. And I would argue that during that era, the four most anointed approaches were busing, Sunday school, door-to-door visitation, and revivals. And they were brilliant because they were all based on people sitting on an 8. I mean, it really was brilliant strategy. Well, they're not on an 8 anymore. Imagine that they're way back on like a 1 or a 2. And they don't have any of that knowledge. They don't believe the truth exists. They don't believe in the Bible, much less its inspiration. They at best, they think Jesus was a good man. They don't have guilt about many of the most basic issues related to morality. I mean, our culture doesn't even blush anymore over those things. And so you're having to move them from a 1 or a 2 all the way down to an 8 where they're even able to responsibly, you know, grapple with the claims of the gospel, much less understand it. And it's that moving them from a 1 or a 2 to an 8 that is what we're having to relearn how to do. And much of it has to do with basic missiology. We understand missionary work at a rudimentary level. If I were to drop you into the deepest, darkest part of the Amazon basin, and you were to reach an unreached peoples group, you would study them, you would learn their language, you would translate the scriptures into whatever form of understanding or communication they used. If you began to offer worship services, you would use indigenous instruments and musical styles that they related to and music that they could understand. You might even dress like they do. We don't even bat an eye at that missionary kind of work, but we seem to stumble and resist it when applied to the American context and this mission field. Mm. And that stuns me.
How do you see it playing out in local churches?
All right, I'll give you two words, and this is not going to be comfortable. I think that one of the biggest things that you face here in the United States is spiritual narcissism. Mm. Let me tell you what I mean by that, and I'll make this brief. Narcissism is built off of the Greek, you know, mythology, the person of Narcissus, who was so preoccupied with himself that he stared at his reflection in the water and never did anything else in life but be self-absorbed. It's where we get our term narcissism, the I, me, mine mentality that puts our personal issues at the forefront of everything. Now, a lot of people think that narcissism has crept in, or consumerism has crept in, with the church, the modern church, selling out and abandoning orthodoxy to get warm bodies. No, I think that where it's really struck has been in among believers who have made the church and the mission about them instead of about the nuns. Listen to how we talk. We talk about going where we're fed, not how we can learn to feed ourselves, not feeding others, but where we're fed. That's what matters. We talk about going where we can be ministered to, as if that's the purpose of the church. You minister to me as a believer, not that you might have a spiritual gift that you're supposed to put into play to make a difference for the kingdom of God out in the world. We talk about a worship service in terms of what we get out of it. We'll literally walk out of a worship service and say, well, I didn't get anything out of it. And that's heresy, because that means that the object of worship is you and instead of God, and that's scary to even think about. Who cares whether you got something out of it? Question is, did God? Worship is what you give, not what you get. Mm. And on and on and on it goes, this self-absorbed mentality that everything exists for me. Now, here's why this flies into the face of the mission. If you're going to do evangelism, that's process and event. If you're going to reach the nuns, your church may have to do things different. You might have to think about different strategies. You might have to actually begin to see that the church may not revolve around you, but may need to revolve around the mission and even revolve around the person who isn't even there yet. Mm. You might have to die to yourself, and that's where your resistance is. We can talk strategy all day long, but that, you know, I could list you 5 or 6 things that might help a church, but it's irrelevant because the heart of the matter is a spirit. It's a spirit that resists the church existing for someone other than themselves. If you know that it exists for the lost, and it exists to reach out, and it exists for the mission, the Great Commission, if you know that, then you don't resist new ideas that might be effective at the mission, even if they inconvenience you, because you know it's not about you. And this is what's missing in the American church.
And my perspective on this, you tell me if you agree or not. A big reason for this is that we live in this radically individualistic culture. I mean, radical individualism, the rise of that in the U.S., in the Western world over the last 20, 30 years has just been stunning. And so it's like that frog in the kettle. We're in the church, we're believers, but we're immersed in this individualistic culture. And so, therefore, it's permeated all those things that you just mentioned when the person was describing what they're getting out of church, what's in it for me. I mean, that would apply to pretty much all areas of life in an individualistic culture, but we're to be set apart. We're not seeing that radical individualism has contaminated our churches.
You're absolutely right. And let's go ahead and not put too fine a point on it. We are worldly as a church in that area, and the worldliness is in our narcissism. And what's ironic about that is that this from a people whose leader says, I did not come to be served, but to serve. Mm. And this was God himself in human form, who, if anybody deserved to be served, it was him. He even said, I did not come to do that. And he does not call us to be served either, but to serve and to give our lives away. And so I think this is really what's key. What's key is, I mean, when you it's so interesting. If you were to go into almost any church, and I love the church, and these people that we're talking about, they're good people. Most of them don't even realize what they're saying and how or how their spirit has been infiltrated. But if you were to go to them and say, do you want to reach lost people? They would say, absolutely. Do you think that the church ought to be about evangelism as well as discipleship? They would say, absolutely. Okay, are you willing to start a Saturday night service and park a mile away to make room for them? Are you kidding me? And see, now again, I'm not saying that Saturday night service is the answer. My point is that if you change the rhetoric and make an application of them dying to themselves in some way, you know, I love reaching lost people, but I'm not giving up those choir robes, or we're not going to have drums, or we're not going to do this, or we're not going to change this style, or we're not going to start a new site, or we're not going to do this, that, or the other. And it's like, well, my gosh, what happened to this reaching the world spirit we had 5 minutes ago?
How much of that?
It's because it dies at the doorstep of narcissism.
How much of that is generational, Jim? Obviously, individualism, narcissism impacts all of us regardless of our age. But some of the things you just mentioned sound suspiciously to me like the older established believer who's always had it a certain way. And how dare you, you know, change the color of the carpet or the choir robes and bring drums into our sanctuary. Obviously, again, we have younger people that are just as stuck in their ways. But is there a disconnect between the, and I don't know where the dividing line would be, if it's the 40-year-old, the 50-year-old, and the younger postmodern person? Do younger believers get some of the stuff you're taught? When you go out, let's say, and talk to a group of 20-somethings, are they nodding their heads saying, yeah, okay, this makes perfect sense. Boy, we need to make these changes. Versus you go talk to a group of 50-somethings, are you going to get a different response?
I think that it's only generational in the sense of what they resist. I think that an older generation might resist and fight the worship wars a little more vigorously than a younger generation. But the younger generation has their own areas where they're just as narcissistic and just as much, you know, what has the church done for me lately, and I want the church to be all about me. They just do it in maybe a hipper, more self-serving kind of way. I mean, the number of books written by millennials about their disaffection with the church and their criticism of the church and how the church fails to meet their needs, I mean, it's almost a cottage industry. Mm. And it is so self-absorbed. And so the self-absorption, it crosses all generational lines. It's just the way that self-absorption plays itself out. Because it really doesn't matter. I mean, that's why I try to stay away from specific strategies. I do talk about them in the book, what I think is the most effective way to reach the nuns, and that's the whole second half of the book. But I started off, and we have to start it off, with this willingness or non-willingness to die to self. Because I can guarantee you, if you're not reaching significant numbers of lost people right now, if your transfer growth is how you're growing, you're plateaued or declining, and you're not having conversion growth, I guarantee you the only solutions will demand change. And so before we talk about those solutions, let's deal with whether you're willing to change. If you're not willing to change, then the solutions are irrelevant.
I guarantee you,
you'll have to change.
When I hear you talking about transfer growth, and I've seen some of the stats on that, I think about rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. you know, my friend Jim Singleton teaches at the main campus of Gordon-Conwell in the Boston area, And he's a Presbyterian, has done a lot of research into the decline of his own denomination, the Presbyterian Church in the USA. And we've seen a huge decline in numbers in the mainline churches. But it sounds like what you're saying is that even among the, you know, the community churches, the mega churches, what we often see is just people moving kind of from one to the other. Well, this one didn't meet my needs, or I didn't like the way that pastor preaches. So
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I pastor a mega church, so I'll go ahead and talk about mega churches. The vast majority of mega churches are mega through transfer growth. That is absolutely true. It's sheep swapping, and there's something about a lot of Christians, evangelicals in particular, that they're insecure, and so they tend to flock to whatever the next it thing is, and they want to be wherever it's happening. So why we flock to a celebrity who becomes a Christian, we all of a sudden feel like, oh, okay, I feel better about my faith now. And so, you know, mega churches really do prey on transfer growth. And very few of them, even if they rack up big baptism numbers, for the numbers of people they have coming, those baptisms aren't as impressive. And secondly, a lot of them are rebaptisms. And that's, there have been studies done on that. Or, you know, reaping the fruits of the children of the believers, or rebaptizing Presbyterians because they weren't dunked and they were done as a child. So we have to be really careful about some of these numbers and really drill down. Are you reaching the unchurched? And either you are or you aren't.
We are talking to James Emery White. He is the author of this new book, The Rise of the Nuns, Understanding and Reaching the Religiously Unaffiliated. We have three copies of this book to give away. And if you're in ministry, if you're a pastor, if you're a small group leader, if you're in some kind of ministry work, give us a call right now, 877-93-FAITH. Give us your contact info, because we'll put you into drawing for a copy of one of these books at the end of the hour. It's 11:48. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with a final segment with James Emery White here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Why do you listen to this station? Well, one friend wrote, I like Faith Radio because I used to be a heavy news talk listener. However, I didn't realize until listening to Faith Radio how badly the sarcastic attitudes of news talk were negatively affecting my life. The positive message that is always given makes me know I am safe listening to Faith Radio. Even if it's about an important issue, there isn't that attacking argument that used to press people's feelings to create negative emotions and more hate. As you think about why you listen to Faith Radio, thank you for praying for us. We do depend on the faithful prayers of friends just like you to stay on the air, to stay effective, to stay focused on reaching people for Jesus Christ. And thank you also for sending a gift as the Lord enables you. Find out how you can give simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.
Helping you grow deeper in your faith.
Motherhood is more than a series of checklists and parenting books. I'm Susie Larson, and on the next Live the Promise, I'll talk with Lisa Jo Baker. She shares her own adventure of resisting and then embracing the journey and lessons of motherhood. And we'll talk about how to honor women who step into the parenting world.
Live the Promise with Susie Larson, weekdays from 3 to 4 on Faith Radio.
To Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. My guest, James Emery White, the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, former president of Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary, and the author of this new book, The Rise of the Nuns, Understanding and Reaching the Religiously Unaffiliated. We've just got about 6-7 minutes left, Jim, and I know in the second half of your book, you get into some of the solutions, and I as you said before, the first step is to realize how we are, unfortunately, we have become very narcissistic, very self-focused, very individualistic in the church, and that is not going to win over the nuns, the unchurched. And our strategies, our 1950s poor spiritual laws strategies, are frankly not going to be effective. Let's talk about some of the things that will work and perhaps what you're doing in your own church there in Charlotte.
Yeah, and with the amount of time we have left, let's just take just one area, and that would be what might be called the new apologetics. There is a new apologetic, quite frankly, that needs to be developed and used when talking to folk. The old apologetic was very evidentialist. It was, it was very Josh McDowell, Norm Geisler, even early Lee Strobel type of work, which was presenting evidence for the faith, you know, arguments for the faith. And there's certainly a place for that, but that's mostly designed to answer Enlightenment era questions. In our world, I find that most of the questions people have are not Enlightenment based. There's a few, but if you were to like describe to them, okay, here's why you should believe the Bible. Let me give you the proof for the empty tomb. Their reply would be something along the lines of, well, so what? I mean, the Bible's true. Well, so what if it is? Jesus rose from the dead. Well, so what if he did? And that's a follow-up question that most people don't know how to answer or even begin to know how to dialogue about. Another aspect of the new apologetics is that I'm finding that many people today are quite bold in putting God on trial, and that a lot of the new apologetics needs to defend the character of God. In other words, when you talk to someone, they might actually feel and give you reasons for feeling why God doesn't seem to be a very good God, doesn't seem to be a very moral God if he's there, that they could do a better job morally running things than he appears to be doing. And so much of what we're doing in terms of new apologetics is defending or explaining or helping people understand the character and goodness of God in light of the world in which we live. This is bigger than the problem of evil. This is getting into the actual choices God seems to be making that in their perspective make them wonder, is this really a good God? Do I want to be in a relationship with that kind of God?
Would one of those examples be this whole idea of how could a loving God send people to hell?
Well, I mean, they don't really think about heaven or hell that much. They would say, tell me why God is allowing this guy to capture hundreds of young girls in Nigeria and sell them for $12 a head. Tell me why this tsunami swept over in the Philippines, where people were already the most vulnerable on the planet. Tell me why, a two-year-old baby was allowed to be raped and tortured and killed. Heaven and hell, I'm not even at heaven and hell. I'm just trying to understand this world I'm in, and you're telling me about this incredible God who I think is asleep at the switch. And again, these are real-world questions, and it's really not so much, where you whip out your old theodicy that you learned in seminary. It's really more of a talk to me about whether this God's really good. So, yeah, I think that the questions have changed, and the kind of things that we're contending for in the marketplace of ideas have changed. And I find it extremely, extremely exhilarating. I mean, if this seems like a depressing conversation to some listeners, all I would say is that, Mac, 7 out of every 10 people we're reaching come from this category, and I'll tell you, they're reachable. And it's beautiful seeing these lives change. And when you see someone who was lost and is found burst through the waters of baptism because you made the effort to be a good missionary in terms of doing what it takes to reach them, it doesn't get any better.
Well, and when you said effort, I think that's the key, Jim, because unfortunately, and I'll speak for myself here, I'll admit, I'm not doing my due diligence to learn the new apologetics as I should. I have a bit of a grasp on it just because of what I do, but I'm not that well equipped to answer some of those difficult questions. I'm willing to enter into a relationship and say, wow, that really is a hard question. And I think a lot of people struggle with that. But the next step, of course, is being able to articulate a response that answers their objection, satisfies that person. But we have so many believers, unfortunately, who are so caught up in the temporal, so caught up in the busyness of life, and frankly, so caught up with social networking and sports on TV, and I could go on and on and on, that they're not going to pick up a book. They're not going to listen to James Emery White's sermon. They're not going to take the time. And therefore, we have this vast number of believers who could be effective missionaries and evangelists who are not doing the work necessary, the mind work and the relational work, the internal work, to prepare themselves. How's that for negative?
It's interesting that you say that, because one of the chapters in the book is actually that is on the solution section is actually called A Mind for God, the importance of a Christian mind. And that is one of the key elements. So you're absolutely spot on.
Turn off the TV, folks, and cut back on your Facebook time. That is a challenge. I wish more pastors would say that from the pulpit, Jim, because I'm very concerned about the number of believers whose their lives are just filled up with nothingness. And I see it every day. It makes me want to go off to a monastic retreat center and just get away from it all. But
well, if it serves people, one of the things that I'm invested in trying to help people who are busy, who may not have time to read all the books and things, is I would recommend churchandculture.org. That website's where I do all my writing and the blogs that are there, and think the resources. It's designed to be a resource on these issues. And if that would serve people, you know, to help save some time, and also in terms of reaching this culture, I would strongly encourage that. It's churchandculture.org, and hopefully that would serve people.
Great. Thank you. Jim, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for spending an hour with us today, and may the Lord continue to guide and direct you in your ministry there in Charlotte and around the world. And best wishes for that little grandbaby, that little granddaughter, she's coming very soon.
Thanks, Bill.
Have a wonderful day. This is the Faith Radio Network. Thank you so much for joining us on this Saturday. We'll be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. Central Time. Have a great weekend.